Let's talk a little bit about hotspots, Lawrence Wittner, around the world today.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to ask you a very general question. Are we in bad shape from a nuclear perspective right now? What's the chances that we will see the third major nuclear bomb after the two we used go off in the world somewhere?
Well, I think as long as nuclear weapons exist, as long as nation states have conflicts and fight wars, we live under the shadow of the bomb. Nuclear weapons could be used. As I try to imply in this trilogy, what has kept them from being used, what has kept the old game from being played out in the nuclear age, the old game being you press every weapon into service for your wars, is that there's been popular pressure, popular revulsion against nuclear war. But at this point, there's great complacency, it seems to me, on the part of the public when it comes to nuclear weapons. And indeed, the fear of nuclear weapons has even been used by the hawks in the Bush administration to justify the war against Iraq. I thought that was very clever on the part of the Bush administration to use this long-term fear of nuclear weapons, of weapons of mass destruction, to actually engender a war in this case. So there, it's latent, but it has not been brought out by a mass movement for some decades now. And as a result, our shield, our real shield against nuclear war, not this Star Wars invisible shield, but this public pressure that has stigmatized the bomb, that real shield is very weak at this point. And unless people mobilize once more, unless they say to the Bush administration that it is not okay to build new nuclear weapons, that it is not okay to resume nuclear testing, that it is not okay to scrap nuclear arms control treaties like the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and the ABM Treaty, we're going to be in real danger. Because not only will the U.S. government be resuming the nuclear arms race and perhaps using nuclear weapons, but other countries threatened by these nuclear weapons will begin to develop their own nuclear weapons. For example, Iraq might well have had weapons of mass destruction thanks to the fact that it was frightened of the United States. And one reason, and this is just a hypothesis, that the Bush administration may have felt that the Iraqi government had weapons of mass destruction was that the Iraqi government tried to convince the Bush administration that it did as a means of deterring the United States. After all, this is the game that's been played by nation states for years. Let me just tell you one story. I think that's fairly amusing. The Russians, back during the 1950s, I guess, when they really couldn't match the United States militarily in terms of nuclear weapons and so on, the Russians would bring out their armaments for a grand display of military strength on May Day. And as all the top leaders of the party, Soviet Communist Party, would get together on the reviewing stand there in Red Square, vast air armadas would fly overhead and Soviet tanks would rumble by to show the invincible strength of the Soviet Union. And CIA analysts would cover this very carefully. They would see how many tanks actually moved by and see how many planes went by and so on. And they were struck by Soviet military strength, which in turn did lead the U.S. government to fear the Soviet Union even more and therefore build even more weapons in the United States. It encouraged the arms race. But they later found out that the Soviet government had done something very clever, although far too clever if you think about it in terms of the arms race, and that was that once their planes had flown overhead, they had them wheel around and fly over a second time.
Yeah.
So the same planes, which looked, you know, the same, no one could tell they were the same planes. They were all the same. They just flew by once more. And so the CIA doubled or even tripled its estimates of Soviet military strength.
Nevertheless, Larry Wittner, you're the expert in this. It seems to me that all it would take is one bomb.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know, we have 3,000, they have, 2,000. These are very dangerous.
Absolutely.
You haven't talked to me about the Middle East yet and
yes.
The use of nuclear weapons. What do you think the potential is there?
Well, I think it's there if U.S. military victories come as easily as this last one against Iraq. And by the way, I'm not saying it's been a successful war in terms of achieving U.S. goals or the occupation which has followed, but certainly militarily, it was a cakewalk for the United States, as it should be, because the United States had vastly more military power than the Iraqi government did. But if victories are that easy for the United States, I don't think it's likely the U.S. government is going to use nuclear weapons. If they're not as easy for the United States, then it becomes more likely that the United States will use nuclear weapons. And if there's no popular pressure that dropping the bomb is not an acceptable means of dealing with other countries, then it becomes more likely that the U.S. government will use nuclear weapons.
How about Israel, for example? Do you think, pressed with annihilation of that country, that the Israelis would use a bomb?
I think so. I think that it's very striking in a way that for many years, for decades, the only powers that built nuclear weapons were the major military powers on the world scene. Indeed, the members of the Security Council in the United Nations all built nuclear weapons. It was, as I suggest, a continuation of the old game that the great powers played and so on. They wanted to have the latest weaponry, and they therefore built the bomb. But Israel is an exception to that general rule. And I think the reason is that the Israeli government for decades has felt so threatened by other nations surrounding them in the Middle East, nations that for many years were dedicated to driving the Israelis into the sea, that the Israeli government said, look, we're going to build the bomb. No one is going to drive us into the sea. We have a kind of Samson strategy that if necessary, we're going to, you know, pull those columns out and bring the whole thing down. And that's, in a further way, why the old game of warfare and some nation states making other nation states insecure makes the situation very dangerous, not just in terms of war, but in terms of nuclear war.
We're talking to Lawrence S. Whitner, Toward Nuclear Abolition, A History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement, and it is published by Stanford. Let me now move to another place that we look at every once in a while, and that's Pakistan, India.
Well, I think that, like the Israeli illustration, the development of the bomb by Pakistan and India shows us that at this point, other nations beyond the great powers, beyond those powers that traditionally dominated the globe, are going to begin to develop nuclear weapons and integrate them into their own conflicts with other nation states, in this case with one another. Oh, and I should just go back a step here, because India is a very good example of a country that was once in the foreground of nation states that condemned the great power nuclear arms race. Under Nehru, for example, India played a very significant role in condemning nuclear testing, condemning the great power nuclear arms race, and calling for arms control and disarmament. But in later years, the Indian government, like a number of other nation states, began to say, well, the great powers have not gotten rid of nuclear weapons. They're still playing the old game. So why shouldn't we have nuclear weapons? Now, in a sense, that question was joined with the struggle over the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was negotiated in 1967-68. The Non-Proliferation Treaty was a bargain between the nuclear powers and the non-nuclear powers. For the most part, people today understand the treaty as just reining in the non-nuclear powers, that new nations shouldn't build a bomb. There should be non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. But in fact, the non-nuclear powers said to the nuclear powers at the time, why shouldn't we build a bomb? You have the bomb. If it's good for you, why isn't it good for us? And the nuclear powers are hard-pressed to counter this because many non-nuclear powers, not just small countries, but countries at the time like West Germany, said, we're not going to sign on to a treaty that has us permanently forego nuclear status if you're not going to get rid of your nuclear weapons. You promise to get rid of yours, and we'll agree not to build ours. And that will secure parity, because none of us will have nuclear weapons in that case. And so that was the arrangement, that was the agreement that's written into the Non-Proliferation Treaty, finally signed in early 1968. And therefore, when there's been an extension of the non-proliferation treaty, as there periodically is, each time the nuclear powers say, oh yes, we're getting rid of our nuclear weapons, you can see the progress we're making in terms of arms control and disarmament. Well, the Indian government and the Pakistani government finally seized on that and said, look, you've had decades to get rid of nuclear weapons. The United States has been building them for five decades now. This was 1998. And therefore, we're going to build our own nuclear weapons. And when you get rid of the bombs, we'll get rid of the bombs too. Now, I'm not saying that was a good thing. I'm saying, though, they could seize the breaking of the bargain by the nuclear powers as a justification for building their own nuclear weapons.
Fascinating background, really is. But would they use them?
I think they'll use them if push comes to shove. If Pakistan, which after all is inferior to India militarily, finds itself about to be overwhelmed, then they may use nuclear weapons. Or there may be a gradual escalation to the nuclear stage.
North Korea.
North Korea is a tough case in terms of solving the problem there. But I should add that the North Koreans, too, have been under great pressure militarily. The Korean War, you know, is technically still going on. Practically, people aren't dying on the battlefield. But there's been no treaty signed bringing that war to an end. There have been U.S. nuclear weapons right on the North Korean border in South Korea. Those are finally taken out as part of the denuclearization policies conducted during the Reagan and first Bush administration. But part and parcel of that was that an agreement was worked out with North Korea that the North Koreans would sign on to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and in turn, of course, the U.S. government wouldn't threaten them with nuclear weapons, which, oh, by the way, is also part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. As non-nuclear powers also said, well, you can't, you know, threaten us then with your nukes if we're not going to build them. And the great powers said, well, of course, we wouldn't do that sort of thing. So, you know, North Koreans signed on, and furthermore, they said, well, if we're going to shut down our nuclear reactors that are producing plutonium that you point out can be used for nuclear weapons, we need some kind of a substitute for these. So the U.S. government agreed to give them the kind of nuclear reactors that don't produce plutonium. Well, the reactors were never delivered. The confrontation with the United States grew more heated as soon as George W. Bush came to power. And suddenly, the North Koreans began to say, well, we're back in the nuclear weapons business once more. Now, I don't mean to justify what they're doing, as far as I'm concerned, pull out of the nuclear arms race forever. But nonetheless, in terms of at least arguments and perhaps their sense of threat from the Bush administration, which has put them on the list of axis of evil powers that have to be snuffed out, the North Koreans may feel threatened by U.S. nuclear weapons or a conventional power, and therefore are building the bomb as their guarantor of deterrence. It's one more sign that if nation states are still going to threaten one another and still going to wage wars, then the possibility exists that it's going to develop into nuclear war.
Let me ask you this, Larry Wittner. We've heard from you today at length about, and a very convincing argument as to people power and how it's affected nuclear abolition. But we now have something else. It's called nuclear energy, sort of a cousin to bombs. Many of the same people who objected to the building of bombs are objecting to the proliferation of nuclear energy in this country on the basis that it could cause a Holocaust, a disaster. I'm wondering whether you'd care to try to marry the two for us.
Well, in fact, nuclear power was the sugar coating to the pill of nuclear weapons. And from the start, supporters of developing nuclear weapons in the United States and refining them and expanding the U.S. nuclear arsenal maintained that there were two sides to the splitting the atom. The dangerous side, yes, was the nuclear arms race, but also a peaceful nuclear power could light our homes and run our vacuum cleaners and, you know, bring a new age of prosperity and happiness for all. However, it began to become clear that that was not the case. For one thing, most nuclear power plants were producing plutonium. And that meant that countries such as India, for example, that had begun to work on nuclear power, claiming that that was only for peaceful purposes, of course, and for economic development, these countries could therefore build the bomb. So it became clear that proliferation and the nuclear arms race could be fueled by nuclear power plants. Secondly, nuclear power plants themselves were dangerous because they could emit radioactive clouds. They didn't necessarily work very well. Radioactivity could seep into the groundwater.
And there was no place to put the spent rods.
Right, exactly. So nuclear contamination could take place. So even if nuclear war didn't take place, these nuclear power plants could be gradually killing us, just as nuclear testing could be gradually killing us, even though we didn't have nuclear war. When those bombs went off, whether in the atmosphere or underground, we were getting this radioactivity that was going to last for millions of years, and it was not good for people or for plants or any living creatures. So I think a good portion of the population has begun to understand that nuclear power plants are also dangerous for a variety of reasons. And by the 1970s, by the late 70s, had begun to question nuclear power and to view this as part and parcel of the nuclear arms race. And the term nukes, for example, has developed by the anti-nuclear power people, meant a combination of nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants.
Are these the children of the same as the people who objected to the bomb?
Well, some of the people who had objected to the bomb had,
Pete Seeger
was died. But many of them were the same. And that generation, which was often the anti-Vietnam War generation, became active in the struggle against nuclear power plants. I should add here that something told to me, and I hadn't realized this till it was told to me by some leading activists, was that they had pretty much given up on banning the bomb at that point. It didn't seem very, very likely by the late 1970s. But stopping nuclear power plants seemed much more feasible. They, too, had gotten a sense that the bomb was part and parcel of international struggles, and they could probably never get it out of the thick of these international quarrels. But maybe they could stop nuclear power plants developing in our own communities. Maybe they could actually shut these power plants down. And so many of them had a rather mordant view of the nuclear arms race, but stopping nuclear power seemed more feasible, especially after the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant underwent its near meltdown.
You're 62 years old. I'm 62 years old. You're decrying the fact that people aren't out there, you know, yelling about this potential menace. It's much like classical music, if I may be allowed the analogy.
Sure.
That they're not being replaced. The classical music lovers are quite frequently not being replaced as they come up. So how do we get to that stage where we can get others to carry this torch?
Right. Well, I think one of the optimistic things about my book is that it shows that at times of nuclear crisis, whether that's just after nuclear weapons were first used in 1945, or with the development of the hydrogen bomb and nuclear testing in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, or during the early 1980s as the nuclear arms race seemed to be spinning out of control toward nuclear war, people do rise up. And there are new generations, in fact, of protesters and people who say, this nuclear arms race is just crazy. We have to stop it. But it would be nice if there weren't lapses into burnout and complacency after those uprisings of citizen activism. It would be nice if we could build a sustained movement. But sometimes, of course, a few victories do bring a sense of complacency. Those who study social movements often find that after the movement gains something, after the women's rights movement actually knocks out the most egregious forms of sexism, then many women drop the cause and forget about women's rights as the cutting edge of social change. And the labor movement is the same way in many senses.
I've been remiss in not asking you about the terrorist threat. We've talked about countries, nation states, but we haven't talked about a madman with a suitcase with a nuclear device in it.
Right. Well, I think that the whole question of terrorism has, in certain ways, been blown out of proportion. Terrorists, at their worst, at their most horrific, killed 3,000 Americans in the 2001 attack. Nuclear weapons, if used, a single nuclear weapon, is going to kill hundreds of thousands of people. And if 30,000 nuclear weapons are used, they're going to kill hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of people.
Okay.
So the nuclear arms race is in many ways much more dangerous than terrorism. But it's also true that it's possible for a terrorist to get nuclear weapons. And that's true as long as nuclear weapons exist. And that's why having them continue to exist is even more dangerous than just seeing nuclear-armed nations use them. But nuclear-armed terrorists can use them, too, and kill an awful lot more people than 19 guys with box cutters killed on 9/11.
And a lot of unaccounted Russian nuclear devices out there.
Yes, absolutely. Many of those so-called tactical nuclear weapons are still in existence. They're warehoused somewhere off in the former Soviet Union in very unstable regions. There are all kinds of people who are poor and desperate and criminal gangs who stand to make money by selling these to terrorist groups or other nation states. I think people should not be as complacent as they are about seeing these weapons still in existence. I think the only safety lies in two things. First, getting rid of nuclear weapons, which, of course, is going to be a gradual process. And secondly, seeing to it, and I haven't really talked about this much, but seeing to it that there's a replacement for the old game of international conflict with a new kind of international structure that will reign in nation states through an empowered United Nations and will see to it that there is national security through the creation of an international security system.
I wish we had more time, but don't you think it's occurring to George Bush and some of the people around him that the UN won't work, that the way to do this is to make sure that we, the United States, are that security? In other words, that we say to everybody else, you can't have the bomb. Yeah.
Well, I think that if one could talk about the new thinking, then that's the old thinking. The old thinking is that if we just have more weapons and we just invade more countries, we're going to be safer. And I think the world's history is that when that old thinking has prevailed, we have had constant wars.
What a wonderful hour we've had with Lawrence Wittner, Larry Wittner, Toward Nuclear Abolition, A History of World Nuclear Disarmament Movement, 1971 to the Present, the third volume of a trilogy of really interesting reading. Larry Wittner, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Alan.
Mommy, mommy, come and see. Oh, mommy, come and look. There's four or five Melinda girls inside this picture book. Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. There were lots of little girls like you before they had the war. Mommy, mommy, come and see. Oh, mommy, hurry do. Here's someone grown up very tall who doesn't look like you. Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. Your father was a man like that before they had the war. Mommy, mommy, come and see, such things I've never seen. There's happy faces all around, and all the ground is green. Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. That's just the way it used to be before they had the war. Mommy, mommy, come and see, and tell me if you can. Why can't it be the way it was before the war began? Come away, Melinda, come in and close the door. The answer lies in yesterday, before they had the war.